Okay, so if I say the name Jimmy Walker, I bet your brain almost instantly fills in the blank, right? Dynamite.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those phrases just instantly recognizable, defined a whole era of TV comedy, J.J. Evans, the whole thing.
Exactly. But that catchphrase, as huge as it was, is really just the starting point for this deep dive. We want to pivot right away, actually.
Yeah, because if J.J. Evans is all, you're missing, well, a lot, the complexity of the man, James Carter Walker Jr.
Right. So our mission today is to really get into that, explore the guy behind the persona. His background is fascinating, kind of technical, actually.
And his stand-up career, decades long, still going, plus his political views, which definitely challenged some assumptions.
Okay, let's lay out some basics first. He was born James Carter Walker Jr., June 25, 1947. Grew up in New York City, bouncing between Brooklyn and the Bronx.
And this wasn't just some flash-in-the-pan sitcom actor. We're talking Golden Globe nominations, two of them, back to back, 75 and 76 for Good Times.
That alone tells you something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Puts him in a different league than just like a novelty act famous for one line.
Totally. And what really gets me and kind of underlines his work ethic is that he never stopped. Unlike a lot of actors defined by one huge role, he kept going.
He started stand-up way back in 1969.
And he's still touring actively today. Think about that. Parts of 6 decades as a working comedian. That's commitment. He's way more than just that one sitcom.
Definitely a road warrior.
Okay.
Okay, so let's dig into that journey because where he started, not exactly Hollywood Boulevard.
No, not at all. Pure New Yorker, Brooklyn born, Bronx raised, Theodore Roosevelt High School. And here's where it gets, well, really interesting and often overlooked.
Yeah, you got to place him in that mid-century New York context, right? He didn't just like magically appear in showbiz. His first real professional track was technical.
Right, radio engineering. He got into it through this New York State program called SEEK.
SEEK, yeah, Search for Education, Evaluation, and Knowledge. That was a big deal back then.
Huge. It was designed to open doors, get minority students into higher ed professional paths they might otherwise miss out on.
So it gave Walker a real marketable skill, not just dreaming of being on stage, but actually qualified in radio engineering.
Exactly. And you see that practical kind of blue collar foundation in his first jobs too, before radio even. Remember what he did?
Oh, yeah, the quintessential New York gig. Vendor at Yankee Stadium, starting back with the 64 World Series.
Working the stands. I mean, talk about hustle. Engaging with crowds, grinding it out. It's a different kind of performance, sure, but you can see that work ethic starting there.
Definitely. So that hustle carries over. By 67, he's full-time in radio, WRVR.
And WRVR wasn't just, any old station. It was the radio station for the Riverside Church. Non-commercial, had a pretty significant profile, often kind of intellectual, progressive even.
So he's surrounded by media. He understands the tech side intimately. You can almost see how that would feed the performance bug, right?
Totally. It's like a perfect setup, from selling concessions to fixing the equipment to then finally becoming the voice himself.
Because just 2 years later, 1969, that's when he officially launches the stand-up career.
And that's the engine. It's so important to get that timeline right. The stand-up came first, fueled everything else. The sitcom didn't make him a comedian. The comedy opened the door to the sitcom.
And that engine was clearly firing on all cylinders by the time Hollywood took notice. He's working the circuits.
And he gets spotted by the Good Times casting director, but not just from like smoky back rooms. He was already on national TV.
Right. Big variety shows, talk shows, Ronan Martin's Laugh-In, The Jack Paar Show. Those weren't small potatoes. That's serious exposure.
It proved he could handle the broadcast medium, translate that stand-up energy, and boom, things move fast.
Super fast. He even put out a stand-up album right at the peak of Good Times fame. Titled, of course.
Dynamite. On Buddha Records, it's like a time capsule of that moment, isn't it? From Bronx radio tech to touring comic to bam, cultural phenomenon, the speed is just wild.
Absolutely wild.
Yeah.
Okay, so that brings us squarely into the Good Times phenomenon itself. Success, controversy, the whole package.
Yeah, because Good Times is the lens, right? That's how most people know him. J.J. Evans Jr., oldest son of Florida and James Evans. CBS, 1974 to 79.
Part of that whole Norman Lear universe. Groundbreaking stuff, just showing a poor black family in the Chicago projects trying to get by.
But right away, you hit this this weird production thing, the age difference. People often miss this, but it says a lot about how much they wanted Walker.
Okay, lay it out, because it's pretty stark when you hear it.
In that first season, 74-75, Jimmy Walker was 26 years old.
Playing a teenager. JJ was definitely not supposed to be 26.
Not even close. And get this, John Amos, playing his father, James Evans Sr., was only 8 years older than Walker. Walker's 26, Amos is 34.
Wow. Okay, that requires some serious suspension of disbelief from the audience.
Totally. It basically screams that Walker's comedic talent, his energy, was just so undeniable that the producers were like, forget realism, we need this guy. They saw a star.
And a huge part of that stardom, maybe the defining part, was the catchphrase, dynamite.
The phrase itself, it feels so organic to him, like it must have come from his stand-up.
But it didn't. And this is where you start to see the seeds of that creative tension on set.
Exactly. The sources are clear. It came from producer and director John Rich.
Yeah, he insisted on it.
Yep. Insisted Walker say it every episode. It was basically a manufactured hook designed to be repeatable commercial.
And the crazy part is, Walker himself wasn't sold on it. Neither was Norman Lear.
Both skeptical, worried it was too silly, maybe undermine the show's serious themes. But the audience.
The audience loved it instantly. Turned this thing neither the star nor the producer really wanted into a cultural touchstone. It almost became bigger than the show.
And Walker, being pragmatic, you know, maybe that logicist side we'll talk about later, he saw the power in it. He definitely leveraged it.
Oh, yeah. TV commercials, right. Panasonic tape players in the 70s.
Cassette and 8-track. And decades later, it still had enough juice that he was using it in Medicare PSAs from 2021 to 2023.
That's incredible staying power for a line he didn't even want.
But, and this is a big but, that success, JJ's popularity, the catchphrase, it came at a cost, a big one, creatively and ideologically.
This is the core conflict of Good Times, isn't it?
Yeah.
The friction between Walker and the lead actors, Esther Rolle and John Amos.
Absolutely fundamental. This wasn't just like backstage gossip. It was a serious debate about Black representation on TV.
Rolle and Amos, playing these dignified, struggling parents, they had a real problem with JJ's character arc.
A huge problem. They saw his character getting more and more popular, but also becoming, in their view, increasingly buffoonish.
They felt it undermined the whole point of the show, right?
Yeah.
The realism, the dignity of this family's struggle.
Exactly. It became this battle for the show's soul. Was it social commentary or just broad comedy? And JJ, well, he was the ratings driver.
But that made him a target. Criticized by some in the Black community and definitely by his co-stars for, you know, selling out the premise.
And that conflict had real consequences. It led to major shifts in the show. John Amos left first.
During the third season, wasn't it? Largely because he couldn't stomach the direction JJ's character was taking.
Pretty much. And his departure, well, it fundamentally changed the show's dynamic. It basically cemented Walker as the star and shifted the focus even more onto JJ's comedy.
Esther Rolle left later, too. Showing how deeply both felt about this.
Yeah, they were committed to their vision of what the show should be. And this conflict, it wasn't something they just, you know, got over after the show wrapped.
No, it seems like it stuck.
Mm-hmm.
There's that detail, pretty stark, about Esther Rolle's funeral.
Right. Walker was the only main Good Times cast member who didn't attend.
That says a lot. It points to just how deep that professional, maybe even ideological, disagreement ran. It wasn't just about scripts. It was about representation.
A wound that never really healed, it seems. Walker's success was directly tied to the very thing his co-stars found damaging. That's a heavy burden.
Okay, so Good Times ends. The defining role is over. What happens next? Because his career path afterwards is all about adaptability.
Phenomenal adaptability. And just relentless work. He knew his face was recognizable, and he immediately pivoted to leverage that guest spots and maybe critically game shows.
Right, the game show circuit. He was all over those in the 70s and 80s.
Became a real regular. The Tonight Show, sure, but being a panelist on shows like Match Game, that kept him visible. It kept the brand alive without the creative pressures of another sitcom lead.
He was on the Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour a bunch.
5 times as a panelist between 83 and 84. Even came back for the Match Game revival in 1990. He was just good TV, funny, recognizable, played the part well.
And the guest roles on scripted TV.
Yeah.
The range is kind of wild when you list them out. He didn't get stuck in just comedy.
Not at all. Look at the variety. Police dramas like Cagney and Lacey. Action shows like The Fall Guy. Then total fluff like The Love Boat.
Multiple times on The Love Boat.
Yeah.
And Fantasy Island. Talk about iconic 70s, 80s TV.
And he kept it going. Through the 90s, appearing on smart meta stuff like The Larry Sanders Show, The Drew Carey Show. Then finding a whole new audience with Scrubs.
The Scrubs appearances were great. Playing himself. Leaning into the whole celebrity thing.
Yeah, my bad and my blind date. Very clever use of his persona. And people definitely remember him from Everybody Hates Chris, too, which felt like a nice nod back to that whole Good Times era.
Okay, switching to movies, he did some interesting stuff there too. He actually starred with John Amos again after Good Times.
Yeah, Let's Do It Again, 1975. Which is fascinating, right? Suggests that maybe the Good Times conflict was specific to that show, that pressure cooker. They could still work together elsewhere.
But his most memorable film roles are probably the comedic ones, the cameos.
Oh, absolutely. Rabbit Test, directed by Joan Rivers. That's a deep cut from 78. But the big one, the iconic one, is Airplane in 1980.
The windshield wiper man.
Yeah.
Perfect cameo. Uses his 70s fame brilliantly without needing the catchphrase at all. Just instant recognition.
Totally. And then, he seemed willing to pop up anywhere. Just kept working. Disaster movies like The Concorde, Airport 79, weird sci-fi horror like The Guyver, Super Shark.
Super Shark? Okay, that's commitment to the craft, or maybe just commitment to working. And a cameo in Home Alone 2. Can't forget that.
He also tried to get back into the sitcom game as a lead. Had a couple of shots at it.
Yeah, At Ease in 83, military comedy. Didn't last long.
14 episodes. And then Bustin' Loose from 87 to 88. That one ran a bit longer, 26 episodes. He played Sonny Barnes. Shows he still wanted that lead role, that ensemble setting.
And then, circling back completely, he returned to radio.
Yeah, in the 90s, back to his roots, that radio engineering background. Hosted shows on big stations, WHIO, WAI, WLS, KK. It's kind of cool, right? Proving his skills went way beyond acting.
Okay, now for the really out there detail. The one that makes you go, wait, what?
Oh, you mean the Spaz connection?
Yes. 1996, Jimmy Walker appears on a split record release with a power violence band called Spaz.
If you don't know Power Violence, think super fast, super aggressive, underground punk, like the opposite of a network sitcom.
It's almost surreal. Jimmy Dynamite Walker and Spaz on the
Right.
same record.
We don't know exactly what he did on it, but the fact that it exists on a label like Slapham Records, it just shows his weird cultural resonance and maybe his willingness to just say yes to bizarre opportunities. He could fit anywhere, apparently.
He definitely controlled his own story later on, though. Published his autobiography in 2012.
Dynamite, Good Times, Bad Times, Our Times, a memoir, good title. And he even had an iOS app that year, Keeping Up with the Times.
And still working. Guest spot on The Bold and the Beautiful just last year in 2023. The man does not stop.
He really doesn't. Which brings us to maybe the more personal side, the philosophy, the politics, because that adds another really complex layer to understanding him.
Yeah, we've seen this incredibly persistent, pragmatic worker. Now let's look at the man himself, his personal choices, and especially his political thinking, which often catches people off guard.
Well, first off, he's kept his private life pretty, well, private. But he did address it directly back in 2012 on The Wendy Williams Show.
Right. He said point blank, never married, no kids.
Clarified he'd had plenty of girlfriends, but yeah, no marriage, no children. Which, for someone who hit peak fame so young, is kind of unusual. Suggests a real focus on that professional path, maybe.
Seems like it. But the really defining thing that came out, especially in the memoir and interviews around that time, was his political identity, which is not what you might assume.
Not at all. He doesn't call himself a Democrat or Republican. He uses the term realist independent.
And he goes even deeper than that, philosophically. In the memoir, he calls himself a logicist.
Yeah, we really need to unpack that term logicist because it's his key, his definition,
Right.
someone who believes in logic and common sense.
And that framework, that specific way of thinking, explains a lot about why he holds positions that are often seen as conservative, placing him in that category of black conservatism.
But it's not like party line conservatism. It
Okay.
seems more based on this individualistic, pragmatic, sometimes contrarian viewpoint. What works, what's logical, in his view, trumps everything else.
Okay, so let's look at some specific examples, just reporting what the sources say about his views. Affirmative action, for instance.
Openly opposed it, stated it pretty clearly
Woman.
that it had outlived its usefulness. Basically, a policy that maybe made sense once, but according to his logic, didn't anymore. It fits the logicist idea. If it's not achieving a practical, common sense goal now, get rid of it. Purely utilitarian thinking.
And he was just as direct about presidential politics, specifically Barack Obama.
Yeah, back in 2012 on Bill O'Reilly's show, he said flat out he didn't vote for Obama in 08, wasn't going to vote for him in 12.
Which got a lot of attention, obviously. went against the grain, especially within the black community's overwhelming support for Obama.
But for Walker, it seems like it was another assertion of that realist independent stance. He wasn't going to be swayed by racial identity or expectation. His logic about policy, whatever it was, came first, resisting the box of identity politics.
But maybe the most telling example of this logicist philosophy in action is on a really divisive social issue, gay marriage.
Right. Because his stance here has two distinct parts. First, he said he was personally against it, on moral grounds.
Okay, so that's his personal belief.
That's the personal belief. But then the logicist kicks in. He immediately followed up by saying that, despite his moral view, he thought legalization should happen.
Why?
Because, he argued, it was not worth fighting against.
That perfectly illustrates it, doesn't it? The personal moral view takes a backseat to the pragmatic calculation.
Exactly. His logic seemed to be, the social and political momentum is there. Fighting it is illogical, a waste of energy. Common sense dictates accepting the reality, even if you don't personally agree with it.
It really shows why that logicist label is so important to understanding his worldview.
Mm-hmm.
It lets him hold seemingly contradictory positions because the ultimate driver isn't ideology, it's perceived effectiveness and pragmatism.
Utility over loyalty. Logic, as he defines it, over emotion or group identity. It explains why he avoids the left-right labels and sticks to realist independent.
And you can kind of see that same independent streak, that refusal to fit neatly into expectations, running all the way back to the good times conflicts right through to today.
It's a consistent thread, yeah, this deeply independent way of thinking.
Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. What are the big takeaways from this whole deep dive into Jimmy Walker?
Well, we've seen this incredible arc from Yankee Stadium vendor, radio engineer, getting a start through that SEEK program.
To becoming this massive, instantly recognizable star almost overnight.
But a star whose biggest success came with huge challenges, intense creative friction, ideological battles about representation with his own co-stars over the very character that made him famous.
And yet that controversy somehow cemented his stardom and that dynamite brand.
And then we see this guy who just keeps working, constantly adapting, refusing to be pigeonholed, defining himself very deliberately as this logicist, this realist independent.
Challenging political assumptions, showing that same independent mind that likely helped him survive and thrive in stand-up.
But here's the kicker, isn't it? Despite this long, varied career decades of stand-up, film roles, radio, political commentary, his public image is still overwhelmingly tied to J.J. Evans.
And to that one phrase, dynamite. A phrase that, ironically, wasn't even his idea and that he and Norman Lear were skeptical about.
That contrast is stark, which leads us to maybe the final thought for you, the listener, to chew on.
We talked a lot about how J.J. became controversial, how Roland Amos saw him as buffoonish, a harmful stereotype.
But that exact character, that exact portrayal, was undeniably the rocket fuel for his entire six-decade career. Its commercial power was immense.
So it forces you to think about the price of fame, right? Walker spent years proving he was more than JJ, showing range, developing this complex philosophy.
Yet the cost of that initial breakthrough seems to have been this permanent commercial branding, stuck with the image of a character defined by a producer's catchphrase.
It really raises that fundamental question for anyone in a creative field, doesn't it? When is that creative compromise necessary to break through to get that success? And when does that compromise become a cage, limiting how you're seen forever?
Does it inevitably overshadow the person's deeper complexity? It's a trade-off Jimmy Walker definitely experienced, whether he chose it or had it thrust upon him. That tension between Jimmy Walker, the thinker, the logicist, and JJ, the dynamite guy, maybe that's the ongoing struggle between art, commerce, and identity in the spotlight.